Hi, I'm Rachel Sosin, and this is 6 Degrees of Innovation, a podcast that grew out of my natural curiosity and love of innovative solutions to big and little challenges. Each episode, I'll speak with someone who is making an impact in an innovative way. Listen in as we talk about what got them started, what problem they're tackling, and how it's going. After my 10th episode, I decided to take some time to reflect on what it is I hope to get out of this whole podcasting adventure. I needed help in thinking through what was working and what my goals might be, so I decided to call on my friend Nick Drage to help me think it all through. In a moment of bravery, I also decided that part of that process should be recording an episode in which Nick interviewed me. I chose Nick because, as you'll soon hear, he's really good at asking good questions and giving plenty of space for thinking. His background is in cybersecurity, but I think his expertise as a thought partner goes beyond any particular sector. In addition to generally asking the right questions to help someone reach their own conclusions, Nick also does a lot of strategy wargaming, which, as I understand it, creates space for teams to explore complicated scenarios with multiple potential outcomes. This can be really helpful in terms of cybersecurity, but I'd venture to guess it also has real value in other strategic areas as well. Anyway, this conversation was more than a little bit scary to record, but I hope you find it as interesting as I did. Hi, Nick. Thanks for joining me. I'm a little nervous to have the roles reversed, but I am really glad that you agreed to switch seats with me and to interview me. Would you like to tell listeners a little bit about yourself and what has made you such a fantastic interviewer and question asker?
Oh, well, it's that, I think. It's taken me literally decades to not only figure out that I'm better at asking questions than just providing answers. Like that kind of consultant that helps you figure out a problem rather than just someone who comes in with the answer, does the required thing, takes the money and leaves. I'm much more someone to work with than I'll work for you. So, and when people have said something about my skills or paid me a compliment, I've just believed them by default. And people have said, you're good at asking questions. So I've decided to believe that. And you said it as well. And, you know, and shown that you mean it by asking me to do this episode. I've decided to believe people when they say that and see where it takes me career-wise.
Can you imagine how different the world would be if we just all simply believed what people told us about ourselves instead of convincing ourselves of all of these untrue, limiting assumptions about ourselves?
Yes. I really dislike the idea of limiting beliefs because some things are just limits. You know, it doesn't matter how hard you wish, you're not going to be that rich or that skilled kind of thing. But I think if you're more adventurous, you find out which are limiting beliefs and which are just limits. And it's as long as you regard it that way. I mean, like you doing a podcast is like, presumably you didn't. Well, I mean, that's the first question to ask is, what's your previous podcast experience? Have you done any sort of student radio, local radio, any of these kind of interviews? Or did you just think, I want to get into conversations with people. Here's an excuse.
100% the latter. As you were asking that, I was thinking like, oh, I'm about to just sound like a real arrogant asshole. I had zero experience. And I mean, I guess when I was a kid, when I was in high school, I was really active in our drama club and I was in all the plays and stuff like that. So I guess I sort of knew that I could talk, but that is definitely different because that's generally scripted. I've done plenty of sort of like public speaking or quasi public speaking in terms of leading workshops and facilitating trainings and stuff like that. So I knew that I can think on the fly and be relatively coherent I knew that I really enjoy talking to people and asking them questions. And I think I'm a pretty decent listener. So I think I figured I had the basic qualities that you need to be a podcaster, but I definitely had no idea what I was doing.
No, that's, I mean, that's how a lot of people start, but I'm surprised to hear that. I'm surprised you've not got like, say at least like student radio or something like that, just because of the way you come across. You mentioned you were sort of a, the note I scribbled down hastily is like drama kid, which I don't know if is fair at school, but your master's is in social innovation. I can think of no better way of asking. It's just like, what is that? Describe what you studied.
Okay. Social innovation is a combination of two words, and social is, you know, related to people and not necessarily community, but for me, community. And innovation is new solutions to existing problems. And when we look at society and we look at the biggest problems and challenges that we're facing, they are largely systemic problems. Poverty is something that affects the entire society and does not have one single solution. And so for me, social innovation is about taking a holistic look or a systems thinking look at a challenge and trying to find a new approach or digging deeper to find a root cause. And I think often when we go to address things that are systemic, using poverty as an example, you know, there are tons of organizations that are often trying to address a symptom as opposed to the actual root cause. And so the way I view social innovation is looking at a challenge with enough of a microscope that you can get down as close to a root cause as you can, or at least to finding a place where you can make an intervention that actually addresses the challenge instead of addressing a symptom. An element of that for me pulls from design thinking with the double diamond. The double diamond, I think, it was originally designed by the British Design Council, but I'm not sure on that, without going into too much detail down that path, because it will be boring for people who already know, and people who don't know probably don't care. But the first portion, so it's essentially like, I guess there's four quadrants, sort of. Anyway, the first part is the problem space. And I think what makes social innovation interesting to me is that the focus is really about spending as much time as you possibly can in the problem space to really, really understand what it is that you're trying to address before you even begin to consider solutions or outcomes. And that has always struck me as unique and different from the way that I ever learned, you know, in my traditional education and sort of general life experience. You know, if you think about an office environment, you know, you have a big, big meeting, all hands on deck. We have a crisis. Bring your ideas. And it's always bring your ideas for a solution. Yeah. It's never bring your ideas for what's really happening. And so then you will get a ton of ideas, some of which are good, some of which are not good, but probably very few of them actually address the problem. And so for me, social innovation is about upending that model and saying, you know, so using an office as an example, we're going to have an all hands on deck meeting. We have a problem. Now I want you all to bring your ideas about why is this actually a problem? And we're going to start there and we're going to stay there as long as we possibly can. And so that's a really long explanation for what social innovation means to me, but it is essentially trying to find tangible root cause solutions for social challenges.
No, excellent. And also it fits nicely into the next question I was going to ask, which was that you ask of your interviewees, you sort of introduce your podcast by saying you're going to ask what got them started, what problem they're tackling, and how's it going? So with regard to what you just described, is your degree in social innovation what got you started? And if so, what problem are you tackling and how is it going?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know.
I realize it's quite mean, literally turning your question around at you.
I apologize now to all of my guests. So I guess in some ways the degree wasn't necessarily the starting point, but I think it was probably the beginning of the conscious part. So in the sense that if I'm tackling any problem, I would say that I have always looked to try to bring out the best in an organization that I was a part of or in the people that I was surrounded with, either in an organization or just within, you know, a friend circle. I think that's a part of who I am as a person. So I don't really know when that started. I think probably somewhere in the last 5 to 10 years, I learned how to do it a little better. I think I've always been a bit of a bull in a china shop, but I think I learned how to root that in kindness. I have much more patience now for like, if just because I can see something doesn't mean that someone else can see something. So I might know that you have fantastic qualities that you should be capitalizing on and you're not, but just because I know that doesn't mean that you know that. And so I need to have more patience with you in that regard, I think. But so I think that's something that I've always been doing. And I think while I was studying, I realized that that was something that I really wanted to hone and prioritize in my professional and my personal life. I also think one of the big lessons that I learned that was sort of a side lesson was that there are some people for whom professional and personal are one and the same. You know, if your professional life very much models your values and your ethos, I guess, then that work personal line becomes much blurrier. And I think for a long time, I always tried to keep them. There was professional Rachel and personal Rachel. And I think when I realized that that wasn't working and it was exhausting, it became much easier to just realize that that wasn't a dynamic that I needed. And that, so that was really liberating. And I think that also helped me sort of lean in more into the idea of helping pull out the potential. And in terms of how it's going, I guess I would say it is going well in the sense that I think I'm making it a key part of who I am, and that I seek out people who are also curious, who are also looking to be their best selves, and who are looking to improve the world around them. And so I think it sort of becomes like an upward spiral. I choose to engage with people who are curious and who are self-aware. And in terms of where it's going or what comes next, I'm not sure, but I do know that it is like that piece, I think, is key for me no matter what.
No, excellent. Thinking of, I mean, what you just said about the difference between personal and professional, and realizing there was a lot less difference, if any, between the two. What's the difference between you and the you we hear on the podcast?
Well, the biggest difference is probably the number of ums that I edit out of the podcast. In my natural speech pattern, I have learned by doing a podcast that I use a lot of filler sounds and become really self-aware about it. But I think I try really hard to make podcast Rachel the same person as Rachel. And so I think that the curiosity, I think, is definitely the same between podcast Rachel and real life Rachel. I do think that podcast Rachel is probably a little bit more esoteric isn't the word I'm looking for, but I often come off of a podcast and think, wow, that person sounded a lot smarter than the way I walk through life on a regular basis. So I guess, not to be self-deprecating, but I think podcast Rachel, I put myself on my A game in a way that maybe I don't all of the time in regular life.
That's an interesting point, in that you're doing a podcast, both as an interviewer and interviewee, you're particularly switched on. So like you say, yeah, bringing your A game, which brings me to the next question is, sort of apart from job interviews, when's the last time you were interviewed? When's the last time you had a conversation when it was literally all about you?
Well, it's interesting. So since I started a podcast, I have now been on two other people's podcasts. One was with Gemma Davis, who you introduced me to and who was a guest on season one. And another was for this podcast called The Values Exchange with Annabelle Lambert and Robert Pye. And I had never met either of them, but Annabelle and I got into a discussion on LinkedIn. And then she said, you should be on the podcast. And I said, okay. And then immediately went, oh shit, I don't even know what their podcast is. Both of those experiences made me feel, or just gave me a much better understanding of how uncomfortable it can be in the interview seat. But also, I think, sort of made me feel like a little bit proud of myself. Like, listening back to both of them again, I thought, huh, I sound a lot smarter than I think I am. So I think that was kind of a nice unexpected outcome. But it's definitely a bizarre experience to be asked questions about yourself, not in a job interview, but also not conversational. It is different. I think being the interviewer feels more like conversation to me, because I get to ask all the questions that are in my head, and you say something and then I get to respond with additional questions. And when the roles are reversed as the interviewee, I felt like I had much less control, and I was having to be the passenger instead of the driver. It is a strange experience, but I think it's been really helpful in thinking about being the interviewer as well.
And I would describe it as you're on defense from an American football point of view, which is one of my favorite analogies, which thankfully leads me into my next question, in that, of course, we don't care about my analogies. This is about you. But you've been interviewing lots of people, and you're very smart, got a very active mind, and think about the conversation you're in. How hard is it for you not to have, so all these interviews you've done with all these interesting people you've chosen, how hard has it been for you not to turn it into more of a conversation? And are there any sort of particular techniques you've used or developed over the first season that have basically, as I say, have meant that you've just asked questions and given the interviewee time to answer, rather than it becomes a chat, which is not the aim of your podcast?
that's an element that I have always been very self-conscious about and nervous that I wasn't hitting the mark on. One of my big pet peeves in listening to interview podcasts is when it really becomes the podcaster talking.
I'm sorry, I should, depending on what you do with editing, I should stress to make life easier for editing Rachel. I'm muting myself when I'm not speaking, but I was obviously bursting out laughing when you were just, yes, podcasts that turn into about the person doing the questioning, which is what I'm doing now. So I should go back on mute and let you finish your answer.
You don't need to mute at all. I never mute myself unless I have like a coughing fit or something. I don't mute myself because I do think it's nice to be able to hear that it is a conversation. You know, it isn't two friends having coffee or at the pub, but it is two people. And so I do think it's nice to be able to hear the uh-huh or the like, huh, yeah, and those yeah. kinds of sounds. But I am very conscious that I don't want to dominate the conversation. And so there have been a couple of episodes where I felt like I was kind of pontificating. And so I just cleared out some of it. But I think in general, knowing that I don't want to dominate the conversation would be the first step. And then the second is generally I'm talking to someone from whom I know I can learn a lot. So I don't want to hear from myself because I don't have that much to offer in that context. They do. You know, I'm talking to someone who has developed a behavior change cybersecurity platform that is unlike anything else. I don't know anything about any of those things. And so I really just want to listen to him. There's a podcast that I listen to that has nothing to do with anything related to this podcast. But one of the things with their structure that I find really interesting is obviously the person is being interviewed, but they remove all of the interviewer. So you only hear the person telling the story.
Yeah.
And I don't think that would work well in this context, but I do think that having that as a frame of reference, I think kind of helps me remember that I don't need to be the one talking. I think another piece I would say is when I started the podcast, the whole motivation for it was I was looking for a job and I was in a new country and I was networking and I was so tired of telling my story. And I really just wanted to hear other people's stories, but I also needed to hyperdrive my meeting of people. So I figured, well, if I just interview people and get them to talk and they'll feel like they're getting to know me without me having to do the rigmarole, and then I can get them to introduce me to someone else. And so then I can network without having to give my elevator pitch every time. I think I've just given you like five different answers. But essentially, I didn't want to have to be the one talking anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah. So now you listen to... It sounds like you listen to quite a lot of podcasts anyway, and you've listened to them before you started yours. Has the way you listen to other podcasts changed? Are you now, do you just listen to them, can sort of switch an analytical side of your brain off, or are you picking up sort of particularly good techniques or well-worded questions or even sort of editing methods or the way, you know, what they do and don't cut out, or maybe they leave something in that you wouldn't. Do you listen to podcasts in more sort of more detail now than you used to?
I think it depends on the podcasts. Because I listen to a lot of podcasts that originate in like radio or television. And so, you know, real bona fide interviewers. And so with them, I don't know that it's changed the way I listen because there on a level that, you know, is just is different. But when I listen to sort of homegrown podcasters, I think I do listen a little differently. I think I do pay a little bit more attention to things like, are they talking too much? I think I've started paying a little bit more attention to like the music and the splits between segments.
Yeah.
Few episodes ago, there was an episode where I had to do a lot of editing. There was like some doorbells. There were some people who came in unexpectedly. There were like a whole bunch of things and I had to do a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And that was the first episode where I decided in the you know, end credits to say that I was the editor of the podcast. And it felt sort of like, I can't believe I'm calling myself an editor. But at the same time, I am. And like, I mean, I am not a sound engineer, but I've gotten much better at it than in the beginning. I can do it much faster. I think that I make some seamless edits and cuts. And so I think I've started to have a little bit more confidence in myself as a one-woman show.
How do you find the editing process? As in, sort of, are you okay re-listening to your own voice, just as that's something people tend to dislike? And do you like going over the material again and sort of able to pay more attention on what your interviewee said? But also, how is it listening back to your own questions? Are you like, oh, I wish I'd used that word, not this word? Or is it just like, well, that's the best question I asked off the top of my head in the middle of the free flow conversation. That's fine. How do you find that process?
In the beginning, I was really just self-conscious as I was listening to myself and felt really weird about it. But I would say by the end of that first episode, I had gotten over it because it becomes very disconnected. So the first part of your question about, is it weird to listen to myself? It was at first, but very quickly I got over that. I will say I don't very often go back and listen to a final cut episode. I feel like I also hear so much more out of the interviewee when I'm editing, because when I am in the conversation and talking to them, there's like the top level listening and the bottom level listening. Basically, there's the part where I'm committed to the person and engaged in what they're saying, but there's also the part where I'm kind of picking up the pieces that I want to ask more about, or thinking about, you know, where I want the conversation to go next. And so when I listen back while I'm editing, sometimes I hear things and I think, you know, wow, I wish I had had the thought in the moment to dig more into this piece. Or, you know, wow, I don't know why I spent so much time asking them about this part, because this part's kind of boring. So I do think that in listening to it back, I hear it kind of differently. It's a little bit like you know, you watch a movie multiple times, you start to notice different elements of the movie. But I actually like the editing a lot more than I thought I would. I think because it makes me hear things differently. It feels kind of creative because, you know, like I said, I do a lot of umming and a lot of pausing. And sometimes those are worth leaving in because they help kind of convey part of the conversation. And sometimes they need to be removed because they're just garbage. So I think that there's something sort of creative about how you can amplify or build a mood or a feeling in the editing process. Now, I keep it very simple. I don't do anything with like levels. I don't do anything with different, I don't even know the words to use. Basically, I just do cuts. And then I string things together. And so that's the level of my editing. But I actually do really enjoy it a lot more than I thought I would.
No, excellent. I mean, that's, especially as you just said, sort of focusing on one part and maybe getting all away from that is like your opinion, your what, how you've changed and what you've learned from being a podcaster is interesting. But I should be conscious of also, it's what you're podcasting about, which is innovation, which is one of those wonderful words that everybody knows what it means until you start to discuss it in detail, and then you see where the definitions can vary quite considerably. What's your definition of innovation? How would you define it?
It's probably a sort of cheating on the answer or cheating on the question, but I think I'm going to reference one of the formative quotes from my master's degree. It's from F. Buckminster Fuller, who also went by Bucky. And he was an architect. He was also maybe a little bit kooky. He was one of the founders or one of the earliest members or something of Mensa. So he was obviously a very smart person. And, you know, sometimes very smart people are also a little funky. But so he had this quote, and I am just pulling it up real quickly so that I can make sure I've got it. This is what he wanted on his tombstone. So he says, "Something hit me very hard once, thinking about what one little man could do. Think of the Queen Elizabeth. The whole ship goes by, and then comes the rudder. And there's a tiny thing at the edge of the rudder called a trim tab. It's a miniature rudder. Just moving the little trim tab builds a low pressure that pulls the rudder around. Takes almost no effort at all. So I said that the little individual can be a trim tab. Society thinks it's going right by you, that it's left you all together. But if you're doing dynamic things mentally, the fact is that you can just put your foot out like that and the whole big ship of state is going to go. So I said, call me Trim Tab." And that, and the call me Trim Tab is the part that's on his tombstone. And I think for me, that's what innovation is about. Innovation is about finding that small intervention that you can make that completely changes the direction of the ship. And I think it also actually ties into my relationship with Judaism, which is that I can't remember the quote in Judaism. I guess I could look that one up too, but we are not obligated to fix the world, but we are obligated to leave it better than it was before. We're obligated to at least try to start the process of fixing the world. And so to me, that's what innovation is about. Innovation is, or at least the innovation that I want to engage with, is looking for that small intervention that I can make that makes a difference for the good of the world, and doesn't necessarily save it, but at least makes it better. And I get that not all innovation is necessarily going to have that kind of positive impact. But in terms of what innovation means to me, and where I want to put my focus, it's around the trim tab and the finding the small intervention in a system that you can make and make a difference.
No, excellent. Nicely put. So season 2 is coming up at date to be determined. What kind of innovators are you looking for in season 2? Oh, and how can the listeners help you find them?
The best way is just to send me an email, which is rachel@sixdegreesstrategy.co. I'm interested in talking to people who are making a difference in education, who are making a difference in the way we approach business. And when I say business, there are a couple of things that I mean. Some of the things that I'm very interested in are in a post-COVID world, using post in a sort of loosey-goosey sense, I guess. Things have changed a lot around priorities for what people are doing, how they're doing it, what they are willing to put up with, what they are not willing to put up with. So I'm really, really, really fascinated by the shift in work culture and the shift in sort of society's threshold for work culture. I'm also really interested in finding new ways of including people in the workforce. I didn't finish a bachelor's degree until I was 39 years and 11 months. And then I did a master's degree when I was 41. So I think a lot about, you know, how we sort of built this like monolithic expectation that in order to be successful, you must go to university. And I just think that's wrong. There are some really interesting things that are happening in business around assumptions about education. And then also sort of along that inclusion line and belonging. I think it was a conversation that I had with Gemma actually about, it's really sort of absurd that we make all of these accommodations for people with different needs as kids. And then when they become adults, we expect them just to get over it. And like, that makes no sense. So I love what Culture Gem is doing to bring inclusion without having to self-disclose. And I am just constantly looking for other ways of that same kind of inclusion without disclosure or destigmatizing disclosure, things like that. Something that I think I've been grappling with for a long time is, how do we make business do good, knowing that not all businesses need to be mission driven? But just because you are not mission driven doesn't mean you can't, you know, treat your employees with respect.
Yeah, and there's definitely other options.
Exactly. Something that I've always really sort of struggled with is this idea of B Corp. Like, I think that the B Corp model is amazing, but it also, I think, sort of leaves the door open to say, well, you know, like, it's okay for your business not to treat your employees with dignity and respect because you're not a B Corp. And actually, we should all simply treat our employees with respect. So I don't really quite know what the innovation is there, but I think, you know, I think sort of B Corp was an innovation that I don't think I actually, I think it was a symptom treater instead of a root cause treater. And so I'm sort of curious about what's the root cause solution that we should have. So yeah, so if there's anyone who's working on that, I really want to talk to them.
Excellent. The holy grail, I believe, of the people you want to interview is Kevin Bacon. For the obvious reason of the whole because he's associated so strongly with the whole 6 degrees idea, but yeah, also because of things he's done. Could you give us a little detail on that? And any, like, I went through my own connections and so on, and there's no one sort of even close in any kind of way with regard to the industries that he's involved with. If you give us a little bit of an idea of why you want to talk to him, and just something for listeners to sort of think, oh yeah, I know someone associated with that, maybe I'll just, as a way to get in touch with, you know, maybe people they haven't spoken to for a while.
Oh my gosh, if someone can get me in touch with Kevin Bacon, I will be on cloud nine. So Kevin Bacon was sort of a tongue-in-cheek inspiration for the podcast, because I knew I needed to use this podcast to get introductions to other people. And as a kid, the game of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon was a big thing. And so that was where 6 degrees of innovation came from. It was, some people think it's 6 degrees of connection, but it's actually 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, which I guess is the same thing. But anyway, so a few years ago, he started a charity called 6 Degrees, and he has just recently started a podcast called 6 Degrees with Kevin Bacon. And what they do, I think, is really cool. So he brings on a fellow famous person, and then the head or the spokesperson or the development director or the whatever of a charity that that person is championing. And I think it's really fantastic because it helps bring so much more awareness to the charity. It gives the famous person a chance to talk about something that they're really passionate about. And, you know, people really like to hear about celebrities. And I mean, that's a generalization, but there are certainly plenty of people who like to hear about celebrities. And so I just thought that actually sounds kind of well aligned with 6 degrees of innovation. Like, we're both really interested in meeting people and expanding awareness for people who are doing good things in the world. So that's my pitch to Kevin Bacon and his team. Please let him come do a podcast with me.
Excellent. Well, it's an interesting challenge, considered, which is what I think you said earlier today, is that your interest is that kind of problem rather than a simpler problem. I think we've time for one last question. At the end of every podcast, you mention maybe I'll be the next, and then you mention someone's name. And I've got a note that I ought to listen carefully to figure out that name and look them up. And I haven't. So if you just explain that all to me and the listeners, that I think that'd be a good ending.
I'm really glad that that's your question, because I thought you were going to ask who did I think was doing something really innovative. And I realized I had nothing at the top of my head for that.
That's a whole series of podcasts, isn't it, to answer that question?
And as I had this moment of like utter panic, as you said at the end of your podcast, you always say, and I was like, oh God. So Sarah Koenig is a journalist. I think she's from NPR, or definitely something NPR-ish, National Public Radio. But she was the host and executive producer for Serial. The first season of Serial was about a guy named Adnan Syed, who was in prison for a murder when he was a teenager, and it was unclear if he had committed the murder or not. And I think it was one of the first podcasts to really go viral in the United States. And she was definitely a completely different style of podcast than mine, but I feel like she sort of set a bar for podcasting. I don't expect myself to ever reach her level. But so I just threw it in there because I just thought it would be kind of funny if, like, one day I got a call from Sarah Koenig and I would have no idea what to say to her. But yeah, I kind of think of her as being kind of one of the first BFDs.
Excellent. Acronym. I think that links in with what you said earlier about having the confidence to aim that high. Like, why not aim for someone in the future to mention you at the end of their podcast in the same way that you mention her? Rather than I'll just do this and I'll have a talk to a few people, and maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. Is to be that ambitious, so which I imagine is part of the reason. I think most podcasts finish about episode 3. People realize how much effort it is, or those great ideas they had for people to talk to, they only had 2 or 3. So you've done a great achievement so far, but presumably you're getting people lined up for season 2, which will hopefully start or conclude with Kevin Bacon.
I hope. I think I have been grappling a lot with what does success look like for this podcast. I don't want to become a professional podcaster because there are other things I want to do professionally, I guess. So success doesn't mean having a viral podcast. I think for me, success is having interesting conversations, having a kind of continual flow of people who are willing to talk to me, and growing the listeners beyond my friends. Because I think that's basically who's listening right now, with occasional strangers listening And that's also part of why I do my own editing and everything, because I'm not really willing to pay someone else to do this, because I don't foresee it ever getting so big that it's making money. I don't want to put in the amount of time that it would take to grow it to that level, in part because, like, that's not where I want to go.
Yeah.
But it would be kind of cool if I expanded beyond my own friend circle, I guess, in part because I like the idea of my podcast helping other people gain awareness of whatever their venture is. So it would, I think maybe that. Thank you, Nick, for helping me figure out what a successful podcast is for me. I think it is.
Thank you for making me look like I ask great questions that help people find answers. I said that at the beginning, and you've helped prove me right. I shall be using your podcast in my marketing material.
But it's really true. Like, just this thought process is helpful, because I think honestly what it is that I don't care if my podcast makes money for me, but I will be really, really excited if my podcast helps someone I've spoken to be a little bit more successful in whatever their venture is. So if it brings them one more customer, or if it like connects them to an appropriate investor, or if it, you know, just gets them a little bit more something, that I think is what success looks like to me for this podcast. And so I don't need to be Sarah Koenig, but I would really love it if at some point, someone that had been a guest on my show called me up and said, "This was really cool. Someone reached out to me because they heard our conversation." That's what success would be for me.
Okay, I'm going to make an editing decision for you and say cut before I started the sentence I'm currently saying, because that was a great finale. That was absolutely spot on.
Thanks very much to my friend Nick Drage for turning the tables, asking good questions, and helping me think about what season 2 should look like. If you're looking for someone to help you extract your own thoughts, or if you're curious about the intersection of gaming and business strategy, drop him a line at nick@pathdependence.co.uk. You can also find his website in the show notes. Thank you to you for listening. Please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and maybe one day I'll be the next Sarah Koenig. If you know someone who would be a great guest, please email me at rachel@sixdegreesstrategy.co or send me a message on LinkedIn. This episode was edited by me. Cover art is by Danielle Brooks. The theme music is Strangers in the Night by Vocalista, downloaded from Upbeat.io.